Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club and Week to Week, the news and political discussion program for Friday, February 8th. Very glad you could join us. I'm John Zipperer, the Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club, and I'm pleased to be your host for today. By the way, if you're into politics, you might want to catch our program with former Vice President Al Gore. It's going to be Tuesday, February 12th in Santa Clara. And is my balloon still here? No. We had balloons here last night because we celebrated the Commonwealth Club's 110th anniversary. And and this isn't just to, because we have no cake for you, I'm sorry. But during that time, all the way back since Teddy Roosevelt, we have had every president speak here except for two, not counting the current incumbent. We still have time with him. We did not get Lyndon Johnson or Jimmy Carter. Now, we've given up on getting LBJ, but Jimmy Carter will be at the Commonwealth Club at last, Sunday, February 24th, when he speaks to us at the Herbst Theater here in San Francisco. So those tickets are going fast. It is Academy Awards Sunday, but you will have plenty of time to get home, change into your PJs, and make popcorn, whatever. Okay, and after our program here today, please join us right out in the other room in the library where we'll have some refreshments, and we can continue our fun and socializing out there. As always in our program, we'll go over the important events of the last week or two. We have a lot to talk about today. That's an understatement. And as usual, let me just remind everybody that any opinions expressed up here are those just of the speakers, not necessarily of the Commonwealth Club, its members, or its supporters. Now let me introduce our great panel for today. Starting on the far end is Gina Bellaria. She's the Assistant News and Social Media Director at KGO Radio. She's also a lecturer in radio and multimedia at San Francisco State University. This is her first time on the week-to-week stage, but she is a longtime veteran of the Commonwealth Club stage because she is our former assistant program director, so we are glad to have you back on stage. You can follow her and all the work at KGO at KGO Radio on Twitter. Next to her is Todd Vogt. He's the president and publisher of, I have to clear my throat because there are a lot of them here, the San Francisco Examiner, the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and as of last month, SF Weekly. So we're glad to have him on our stage for the first time, and you can follow him on Twitter at SF Examiner Prez, that's P-R-E-Z. And right here is Deborah J. Saunders, the columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle, for which she also writes the Token Conservative blog at sfgate.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Deborah J. Saunders. So there are question cards on your chairs. Please feel free to write out any questions. I'll try to answer ask as many of them for our panel here throughout the program. Question cards, we'll try to answer as many of those. And at the end of the program, we're also going to do a news quiz. We'll get two people up here. We'll have you go after the questions together or oppose. I am not speaking well today. Let's start over.
The headset.
It'll be a competitive news. Yes, I'm blaming the headset. It'll be a competitive news quiz, and they'll be able to ask you to help them if you want. The first prize will be, of course, the pleasure of knowing you won the first prize. Now, first, let's get to some of the issues of the week, or the more than a week. In fact, let's stretch all the way back to November. Everyone heard the Republicans did not have a great November. We were talking beforehand. Back in the 1980s, the liberal political journal, The New Republic, used to publish what they called their quadrennial recriminations issue every 4 years after the Democrats would lose their presidency, or the presidential race. And that was the issue where they would have various Democrats and liberal writers basically point fingers. You know, you're the reason we lost the campaign. We need to do this. The party needs to become this. We're doing this wrong. That kind of continued until, of course, they learned how to win elections again. Now the shoe is on the other foot, it seems. So let me just kind of throw this out. Let's start with you, Deborah, if I could. We are seeing efforts among some Republicans to change the candidates who are put forward to try to get what they're considering more electable candidates nominated. Can you tell us, can you kind of handicap the activity so far?
You know, I haven't seen you since the election, John. So I want you to know I'm doing okay. Do you know what it's like when you're a Republican going to work the next day after the election? You know, you steel yourself up. And I got to tell you, I thought Romney, about a week before, it seemed obvious that things had changed. But if you'd asked me a month before, I thought Romney was going to win. So it broke my heart, just in case anybody cares.
Though I must put in on her side, here, and it might have been in our first program last February, you actually did predict at that time. You said it's very likely at this point that Obama is going to win re-election. So you actually can claim credit for being right and wrong on this.
That's like everything else, right? You go into work the next day, and everybody says, oh, are you okay, Deborah? I hope you're feeling okay. And then they say, but your party deserved it. And, of course, you know, oh, great. So, this is not going to work. My ears are hard to tame, I guess. No, that's okay. I can hold this.
Okay.
I'm fine. Is this okay? Yeah, right. So, the truth is, yeah, we had some bad candidates last year, really bad candidates last year. And Mitt Romney happened to be the best in a pool of not great candidates. I'm not going to say he was. We know that there were problems with Mitt Romney. Basically, who he was his problem. But I thought he should be. I thought he should be president. So I'm not going to sit around and beat him up like a lot of other Republicans have. I think his mistake was, if he had a mistake, it was running for governor of Massachusetts and winning, because he had a bunch of stands then, and then he switched to a bunch of different stands later, and it completely undermined his credibility. Parties beat themselves up after they lose. And they should, look at their positions on that alienate voters. And the Republican Party is in the process of doing that. And you see the base, the Tea Party folks, fighting the Karl Rove types. And they're going to win in some states and lose in some states. But it really comes up to, I think what the party has to do to change itself more than anything, more than any issue or anything else, is just looking for people with experience in governing. It hurt Mitt Romney even though he had been the Massachusetts governor, since he barely talked about it, it was hard to remember. And I think the party just has to have a certain kind of respect, learn to have respect for people who have grounding in politics in these issues. And I think that would go a long way.
Todd, what's your take on what's happening and what we're going to be seeing?
Well, I now know 13 Republicans in San Francisco, so I equate what's happening in the city on a local level with the progressive movement. It's quite similar to what I see and what I feel is happening within the Republican Party. You get five progressives in San Francisco in a room, and in 15 minutes they'll factionalize five different ways. And I agree. I don't think any one particular group within the Republican Party right now has a clear enough focus, control, or agenda to guide the party forward. You have the Tea Party folks, you've got the NRA folks, you've got the Christian conservative folks, everyone battling for power with different agendas, self-serving agendas, and I respectfully think that, as opposed to seeking out people with political experience and grounding in politics, me, my generation, I am dying for non-political people to get involved in the political process. I don't want career politicians anymore. I want people who sincerely want to make a change from both sides of the House. I am sick and tired of, I have a legion of, I think, 130 followers on Twitter. And I gained a little bit of notoriety in town because I've been calling for Nancy Pelosi's resignation. I am tired of that type of machine constantly anointing the next person who is going to represent the 12th district. I think everyone should rise up and say, we've had enough. On the right, I'm a Canadian, although I'm a U.S. resident, I'm a Canadian, so I'm fiscally very conservative, socially very liberal. So I'm kind of lost in the States. But I am dying. I'm parched for just some hope of someone. When Obama first came out of Illinois. I was in Chicago when he was a state senator, and I bought into the whole change. Democrats, I apologize for this, but there's been no real change. There's been no change in Washington. It's as partisan as it's ever been, worse in some ways. So I think the Republicans have four very ugly, hard years ahead of them, and I don't see anyone within the party right now rising up to be the Barack Obama of the Republican Party right now. I think they're lost.
Gina, you've been nodding your head at the talk about getting in new blood, if you will.
Well, yeah, I have to say what you said really resonated with me. I'm also fiscally fairly conservative and socially very liberal and have no place, you know, in that. I've migrated toward the Democrats. There's a meme going around on Facebook from MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, says, you know, yes, I'm a Democrat, which means I believe in most of the Eisenhower Republican Party platform. You know, the shifting of what the parties believe in and where they are and where they're going. And, you know, you talk about political experience. And it's funny, I agree that there's got to be some political experience because you have to know how to navigate your way through what's going on there and work within it and maybe try to change it. But I also agree that you need new blood, you need to stand for something, and you need to believe in it. You know, I mean, it may be quite idealistic, but, you know, but this whole idea of I'm going to anoint the next person and we're going to play this game and it's all about moving the pieces and playing the game. I am so hungry for someone to just govern well and care about the people again. And I'm hungry to see people work together. That's what I want to see. And I'm hoping that this sort of like, moment the Republican Party is going through, that it will shake out into a Republican Party that is willing to sort of stand up for itself, but also work together to move the country forward. And then another piece of that is us, you know, we the people. I also worked at a place called California Forward, which is a nonpartisan governance group trying to help fix California's governance issues. And so the idea, you know, one of the biggest ways to help move that process forward is the people. If we pay attention and we engage in a different way, it's so easy for us to just be like, fine, I'm casting my vote. Now I'm going to go about my business. I'm too busy to deal with it. And absolutely, lives are busy. But to just pay a little bit more attention to what's going on, speak up, have a bigger voice. So there's what's happening with the party, but there's also how we can impact where the party and governance as a whole moves.
I didn't know if you wanted to jump in.
Appreciate that.
Sure. Well, if I would, it's interesting. I mean, economist Paul Krugman kind of approaches some of that issue. I think he would disagree with you on the idea of, you know, it would be nicer to not have the conflict. It would be nicer if these people could work together. And he's basically saying, no, you actually get stuff done by standing for something. And you could say that the Tea Party people would be saying much the same thing. You know, why give up our principles? Let's stand for something, and if that means we lose the senator's race in Missouri, we lose the senator's race in Missouri, by gosh.
Can I follow up with that?
Sure.
I respect and understand and think it's important to stand by your principles, but if in a marriage or a relationship it was always like, no, I'm going to stand by my principles, everyone would end in divorce or break up. You know, there was a time in Washington where people would battle on the floor and then go out for a drink or play a game of basketball or whatever. There was a time when you were standing up for your principles, but you were also going behind a closed door and being like, all right, how can we hammer this forward so we can get something done? And I think it's about getting something done. I'm truly very idealistic, but I don't expect everyone to be like, you're my best friend, Mr. like opposite party. It's just, I think they've got to find a way to move things forward.
And I don't think this president, I mean, I have to tell you, as a conservative, what I'm seeing is in Washington, I mean, I liked your remarks a lot, Todd, about San Francisco and how you want to see people get involved. But when you're talking about Washington, you want to have people who know how to get things done in there. And I think one of the problems we've seen with this administration is we have a president who didn't always know how to work with the Senate. He doesn't know how to work with Democrats particularly well, doesn't know how to work to get packages done. But there also is this feeling that I see the president just trying to make Republicans look stupid and not cut deals like on the sequester would be a great example. And there are Republicans who keep saying that they want to cut government, but they're afraid to, and they don't really want the cuts. And so what you see right now is nothing getting done. There is no real adult right now. I mean, I see the president doing, I can't believe that he hasn't come up with a better sequester deal. It's amazing to me. And the sequester deal, as everybody here I'm sure knows, $85 billion in cuts this year, half of them in the defense budget. We had a 1% decrease in GDP in the last quarter, and everybody's convinced it's because of these defense cuts. Now, Krugman has written about this. You were talking about Paul Krugman. He's talked about how difficult it is when you have this recovery going right now to cut things. It hurts the recovery. It also hurts the recovery when you raise taxes. Everybody is, and you're trying so hard not to move things so that things don't completely tumble. But this is when you come up with a deal. This is when you come up with a deal to fix entitlements. And there just isn't a push in Washington to do that. Instead of making a lot of really harsh cuts now, you can set in motion cuts where you change formulas, and that would make Wall Street feel that Washington was adult. It would make voters understand that leaders know how to get something done, and it's not happening. It's very frustrating.
And it is. We're, of course, talking about from the Republican Party angle, but you bring up the Obama administration. And that is something we've seen, a change in tone from his administration since the election. We keep hearing this over and over from articles about him, interviews with him, profiles of him and his staff, that, if some conservatives said he was the one who wouldn't negotiate with the Republicans, he wouldn't compromise, well, now he seems to be even less likely to do that, that he's basically said, I can't do business with them. So is that actually something the Republicans can pivot off of and do something with, or does that just mean mess?
Well, I mean, we can
or point, success for we, the
we can
president.
Point, we can point out to people, and by the way, Bob Woodward said that President Obama scuttled the grand bargain, and so did the New York Times report it. So it's not just conservatives who have said it. But where does that get us? That's the problem. Yeah, we can talk about how this is a president who doesn't really want to do the right thing. He just wants to keep winning and poking people. But what does that do for this country? I mean, we need to start working. We need this economy to start working better. It's doing well in San Francisco, but we need jobs for people. And so, yeah, Republicans can try to get points off of it, but I don't see how that helps us.
I agree. I think these next 4 years, I can't even think about the next presidential election. I'm worried about the next 6 months. Q3 and Q4 of 2013... could be abysmal. Any hint of recovery that we felt could vaporize if the White House doesn't finally get some initiatives through to really cement I don't believe there's much recovery myself. I really don't. I think what it is a little bit of window dressing and just the natural cycle. But the little bit of recovery that people seem to think there is could be totally squandered away. And 4 years from now, this president with a second mandate, where he and his administration have phenomenal opportunity for change. It's a pivotal time in this nation's history, in the world economy as well, that this country should be taking the lead. And it's early. It's early in the second term. I don't want to sort of say that it's going to be a disaster. But if it continues this way, it will be a disaster. And I don't know who from the Republican Party or the Democratic Party would want to step up and try and clean it up if the president continues the way that he has for the past 4 years and 3 months. It would be a disaster.
Kind of pivoting off of some of what you said about new blood, when we look back at what the Democrats went through in the 1980s, and they were kind of in the political wilderness for a while until arguably the DNC, the Democratic, or DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, the Bill Clinton faction, basically had their victory and took over. Can that new blood, and there's a question from the audience which I'm trying to work into this, which is about a third party. And that often comes up and it always gets shot down. But is that a place for new blood, or is that just a place where that pressure goes off into a third party, and then the two big remaining parties get to stay even purer, if you will, if that makes sense?
If I can jump in first. Canada has, the parliamentary system has been, it's unbelievable. No party in Canada. You have the Conservatives, which would be slightly left of the Republican Party, but they're the Conservative Party in Canada by name and ideology. You have the Liberal Party, which is the middle-of-the-road party, which would be, I don't even know who in the Democratic Party would represent sort of true liberals. And then you have the New Democratic Party, which are the socialists, the ultra-left wing. Nothing gets done in Canadian Parliament. Nothing is accomplished, because no one knows what any of the parties stand for. The party platforms and ideologies change with the wind. And would the third party be further to the left or further to the right or in the middle?
So America is actually a model democracy compared to Canada.
It is.
We've got it right here.
The third party, it seems that the third party in the U.S. has become a way to take votes away from the other two parties, so that, if someone had sort of an edge, that third party candidate might, deteriorate.
Sure, would we even have had a President Clinton if Ross Perot hadn't been around?
Exactly. Would we have had a President Clinton, and what would have happened if, I'm sorry, names are escaping me today, if Ralph Nader had not run in 2000? So, what would have happened in those two elections? So I respect the idea of a third party. I think Canada is a good example for maybe why we won't want to do that. Especially if the two parties are not representing the majority of the populace. Either the two parties have to figure out how to represent the populace or bring them on board, or there's the possibility that a third party could come up. So far in our history, it hasn't really gained traction.
Sure.
And I don't know how it would impact us, but I think the two parties should really try to figure out.
I don't know who the Republicans, is it true that now the Republicans just represent rich white people and the Democrats just represent minorities and special interests? I don't even know who belongs to who anymore.
Who belongs to whom?
Whom?
Thank you. Yes. I got the biggest mic now.
Yeah.
So, but I feel like elections really are all about who do Americans hate? Whom do Americans hate the most? Correct myself. Whom do Americans hate the most? That's what always happens in an election. And in 2012, Americans decided that they hated Republicans more. You can't do that with three parties. So I think we're going to keep the two parties just because we have this thing.
Okay. Well, I'm going to stick with you, Deborah, because the next topic I wanted to get to was something we also touched on in this election, which was changing drug laws. We saw two states vote to legalize recreational marijuana use, Oregon and, I believe, Washington. You've been covering this a lot. Can you tell us what the state is of the so-called war against drugs, and you've got some problems with it?
Well, and when we were talking about the third party thing and how the parties can change, I think one of the things that the Republican Party can do is bring out its libertarian streak more. It was amazing. I mean, the candidate who never had a chance of winning but always got enthusiastic young voters to come to his events, that Republican was Ron Paul. And what you see in this administration, though, is really fascinating, because, you talk about how you think you want to have somebody who's going to change government, somebody who's new. And I think a lot of people thought that when Barack Obama was elected in 2008, I thought it, that he would make some good changes in federal drug laws. The mandatory minimum sentences are completely draconian. And I thought he would come in and make some changes. He certainly talked that way before. But as president, he has actually been tougher on California's medical marijuana clubs than George W. Bush. And it is the people sit around and scratch their heads who are in that sort of area. And the question is it the U.S. attorneys making Eric Holder, the attorney general, and Barack Obama be overzealous in their prosecution of medical marijuana, or is it the administration? Is this what Eric Holder wants? And you know what? It doesn't matter, because what you have is over-enforcement. And when I talk about over-enforcement, let me say this. When Californians voted to legalize medical marijuana, we knew that they were going to be in violation of federal marijuana laws and that people could be arrested by the feds for marijuana use. When Barack Obama ran, he said, however, that he didn't want to really go, that he thought there were better uses and better priorities from the federal government. Well, under this administration, it's one thing if a U.S. attorney sees that there's a medical marijuana club that's breaking the law, go after them, prosecute them. But what they're doing instead in some areas is they're just seizing things and not prosecuting. In other areas, they're also going after, if medical marijuana clubs want to pay taxes, they're going after them. So this is an issue. I don't think the federal government should be doing this. And
it should be strictly state.
It should be.
Should it be a state issue totally?
It should be a state issue. I mean, if there's and what they're really trying to do is shut down California's medical marijuana law. I don't know what they're going to do, and they haven't said what they're going to do about Colorado and Washington. It is going to be fascinating to watch.
Gina, I know KGO has been doing some reporting on this. What have you seen?
Yeah, you know, what I've seen, I have to say that, you know, I personally am quite, just to piggyback off what you said, quite confused by what the federal government's role is. I mean, I'm a fan of Barack Obama and what he's done, but this is one area where I'm flummoxed by the choices that are being made. Why are they continuing to do this when there were indications that it wouldn't be this way? It's really interesting because you have the federal drug enforcement, you've got the state drug enforcement, and now you've got the city level drug enforcement. There's a case before the California Supreme Court right now about who has the right to, you know, do the cities have the right to ban marijuana clubs outright, or do they have to follow state law and allow pot clubs within city limits?
And have there been localities that have outright?
Okay. Yes, several localities have outright banned marijuana clubs. And so you've got these three levels of government all trying to weigh in on this drug law, and there's not a lot of clarity. So, you know, I think there needs, I would like to see some clarity, and who knows how it's going to shake out. It would be great to see the federal government, if there are laws in place, the federal government needs to enforce them on a national level, such as, you know, drugs coming in from other countries. But I agree with you. I think this would be better served at a state level, and states are trying to speak. You know, a few states here and there are trying to speak about it. So
mention this to your member of Congress.
Who is someone you want to get rid of, Todd?
Todd, don't.
Well, one of our great writers, Caitlin Donahue, is actually here today with us, and she follows this topic closely for the Bay Guardian. And since I've been here in San Francisco, I think it's the epicenter. I'm the newbie here, but it seems to be the epicenter of the medical marijuana debate.
And San Francisco, Oakland.
Oakland.
Yeah. And the Bay Area. That the Attorney General of the United States is shaking down and threatening building owners, threatening legal action against building owners for leasing space in their building to licensed medical marijuana clubs. It's preposterous. Like, do we have nothing better to, are there no more pressing issues? The whole gun debate, which I know is on the agenda today, mm-hmm. Medical marijuana is getting more attention, or up until the terrible tragedy in Newtown. Marijuana was a higher topic of conversation with the Attorney General than gun control. It's crazy.
I know there was in the Marina, there was a marijuana club that was due to open, and those plans just got scuttled. And the controversy on that was there were so many. There was the fear of the federal prosecution, fear of everyone living around it, just because this would be, if you will, a pot club in a very good neighborhood. So if you're going to go get your medical marijuana, or, quote, medical marijuana, whichever, you're going to go to the good neighborhood rather than the bad neighborhood where, you know, your chances of being robbed or something might be worse. But nonetheless, then they got into all the issues of the different communities. So you'd have people coming into the city from, you know, other places where it was more restrictive. It seems that, you know, we've got federal laws, we've got state laws, we've got the locality. I wonder if we are starting to see some clarity come about, at least to the need to do something about that. And, you know, these states going ahead and taking stands really against the federal laws, or if it's just getting messier and more complicated as everyone tries to go their own way on this. Any thoughts? No?
I think you summed it up very nicely.
Okay, well, that ends the Bill Maher part of our show. Well, let's talk about gun control and gun violence and yes, something that really we've been seeing a number of what can only be called massacres, mass shootings throughout the last few years. But the Newtown, Connecticut elementary school shooting seemed to just stun everybody pretty much across the board. I mean, it's one thing. I mean, it's hard to even talk about this where you're saying it's not like the other things are not upsetting. But when you're talking about, you know, a 5- and 6-year-old kid, that sobers a lot of folks. Where do you think this debate is going, or is it not going to result in anything? I mean, the feelings on guns, we tend to associate NRA with the Republicans, but there are a lot of, you know, the Democrats have not even, for the most part, brought up this issue for many years because they realize nationally this is a losing issue for them. So, Gina, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say the people are so entrenched. People who are making decisions about this issue are so entrenched in their, you know, their opinions about it. I think that horrible tragedy in Newtown is the first real doorway that may allow us to do something to find a way to reach common ground on this issue, although the talk since that tragedy happened has not necessarily been everybody coming together. There's certainly still the same people lining up on the same sides. But I do think that there is a real opportunity to maybe do something. I don't know what. And the fact that, you know, Joe Biden is a decent deal maker and someone who can sit down and talk to lots of different people. And I, you know, we'll see what he comes up with and how that goes. And also at the state level, we just this week, we had the announcement in Sacramento of a set of gun control laws. So California is willing to pursue, you know, more law, you know, even more restrictive laws on gun control, whereas at the national level, there's still the pushback. And of course, there'll be pushback in California. It just seems like, you know, maybe now, maybe for the first time, it's not necessarily a third rail issue.
Deborah?
My attitude about gun laws is similar to my attitude about marijuana laws. I really believe I'd like to see government focus on doing fewer laws and making them work instead of passing a bunch of laws that will not work. I'm sorry, I look at a lot of these proposals for what they want to do about guns, and they're not going to stop gun violence. They are not going to people who break the law are going, and let's face it, this Newtown tragedy is awful. But it's not necessarily an area where you want to write all your laws off of, because we know that people are killed by gun violence every day, and there are children who are, I mean, it's as horrible when kids are gunned down, and there's a very high murder rate in Chicago as it is when it happens in a classroom. So this is
the girl who performed at Obama's
inauguration in Chicago is a perfect example.
Shot down in Chicago recently.
But I have to tell you, we have 300 million guns in this country, and I don't see how passing a law that says that you have to get licensed every year is going to do anything but punish people who are law-abiding.
But is licensing a punishment? I mean,
annual licensing, we don't do that with cars. I mean, that's just to make it difficult for people. And the taxing bullets, well, you're not going to go to a shooting range and be more proficient if you have a big tax on bullets. This is simply a way of harassing people who are law-abiding, and it's not going to do anything to dry up guns among criminal elements. I'm for reasonable. I am not an absolutist on this, and I'm for some reasonable laws. And I supported the assault weapon ban in California when it passed, but guess what? It didn't work. It didn't do what, and so I understand Sacramento's probably going to pass a bunch of laws that make everybody in Sacramento and people who don't own guns feel more smug. But whether or not they're really going to reduce gun violence in California, I doubt.
I agree. I think I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, so Newtown hit us all hard. But the day it happened, I was flying to meet up with my family, and it shook me to the core. But I'm of two minds. I think I totally agree. I can't even comprehend what new gun laws will do to limit gun violence. If people want to keep assault weapons, they just won't get licensed. And they're going to get caught when they go and they kill 20 innocent children at a school. The gun law is not going to take that gun away from them. It's not going to stop that whatever is wrong with them from... At the same time, I do not understand, I can't understand on any level the NRA's argument. The right to bear arms is in the Constitution. We live and die by the Constitution in this country. I don't believe, and I know you've heard this a million times, I don't believe the Second Amendment meant for assault weapons and hollow point bullets. I just don't.
You know, Todd, of course it didn't. The problem is that the people who write these gun laws don't really know much about guns. Now, I'm no expert, okay? So I don't want to sound like I think I know a whole lot. But when they passed the assault weapon ban in California, I just read David Talbot's book, Season of the Witch. And in it, he kept talking about all these crimes in San Francisco. By the way, it's a fascinating book. I recommend it. It's about San Francisco. And every time there's a gun involved, he called it an automatic weapon. Well, clearly he doesn't know the difference between an automatic and a semi-automatic. And a lot of times you'll hear people using the word assault weapon and semi-automatic as if it's interchangeable. No, a semi-automatic has a clip or whatever those things that go in there. But the thing is, you can't pass laws. The technology is such that you're either going to ban all semi-automatics, and even still with all the guns out there, I mean, it's just not feasible that you're going to do it in a way that doesn't interfere with the rights of guns that are already, you know, owners of people already have guns that would fall into a category that a lot of people would like to ban.
I understand what you're saying. And just to clarify, like, I grew up in a house with guns and have no problem with guns at all. I hear you that a lot of laws aren't going to do anything to help, but putting our heads together to figure out what we can do. I mean, you know, we get licensed for driving. We have to give our driver's license to get Sudafed.
And we shouldn't have to.
And
you shouldn't have to show your driver's license to get Sudafed.
But sensible, reasonable, whatever that means, and I don't know because I'm not a lawmaker following these things, but, you know, if I wanted to buy a gun, I would expect that they would check me out before I got a gun. I would really be okay with that.
I think any new gun laws will be as effective as marijuana laws. That's how effective I think. If people want guns, they're going to have guns. If they don't want to get licensed, they won't get licensed. If people want marijuana, they're going to get marijuana, whether it's legal or illegal, whichever state they live in. It's crazy, but... As a society, we have to do something to curb gun violence. I have no idea what it is, but we have to do something.
Okay. Well, we'll revisit that. We've got some specifics from the audience on this, so when we get into our question and answers in a little bit, we'll come back to that. But I wanted to get to one last topic, and that is we have kind of been on a heavy dose of foreign policy, national security news with just in the past couple of weeks. We've seen, of course, Secretary Hillary Clinton depart the State Department after having a very interesting hearing with the U.S. Senate and the House, followed by John Kerry coming in. We've seen Chuck Hagel confirmation hearings, and I believe the John Brennan CIA director hearing still ongoing.
There's going to be a classified one next week. We can't watch that.
They'll release that video sooner or later, I'm sure. But one of the topics that has kind of come out of this and risen to the top is the whole issue of drones. These are the unmanned airplanes that we've used both in just for surveillance, like the one that the Iranians downed last year, as well as the ones we've used for what they're called, you know, targeted killings of suspected terrorist leaders. What do you see coming up? Because this has become, there have been charges with the drones, kind of two issues. One is whether they work or not, or whether they're having more collateral damage than others, than other approaches. But the other is hypocrisy. I believe you've touched on this.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, to watch, I remember during George W. Bush's presidency, all of the outrage that many people had on the left about enhanced interrogation techniques such as waterboarding. And it's just sort of astonishing. And by the way, one of those people was Barack Obama, who said that those enhanced interrogation techniques go against our values. So what does he do? He keeps authorizing drones to go kill people. Well, guess what? If I were given a choice between being waterboarded and incinerated, I know where my choice would be, and my choice would be I'd rather be waterboarded. There were three people who were waterboarded. It stopped in 2003. And, I mean, basically the CIA, I think, really didn't enjoy doing it, and that had had a lot to do with what happened. And yet, and by the way, I mean, I support the president's ability to use drones in specific circumstances when it's vital to our national security. But as the New York Times reported, and the story came out the morning my column appeared, it's not just that we've killed civilians, and I know that they're killing fewer civilians, and that's a good thing.
Fewer than if they had to send in troops.
Or even with drones. They're actually perfecting the technology so that they can keep the collateral damage down. But we also know that they're, you know, it's seductive, and that when you have this ability to just order, you know, it's like you just push a button, and boom, people are killed, and there haven't been a lot of negative consequences. It's the sort of power that you can tend to overuse. And the New York Times had a story this week about this man who was very against Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Al-Qaeda representative said, "We want to meet with you." He didn't really want to do it, but he agreed. He invited his cousin, who was a cop. And while they're talking, the five of them, they're all killed by a drone. And here we are. This is not good. This is not a good thing when we're using drones and they end up killing people who should be our allies. So it's a problem.
Do you have any?
Well,
time?
War is war, and the CIA director nominee said, I think it was yesterday, he said, it's a choice of either putting American soldiers' lives at risk to go and to do these missions or to use the drones. War against bad people, good people, have always, unfortunately, been killed as well.
Is it wrong to waterboard and okay to use drones?
Well, I'm not talking about the hypocrisy because
it wrong to waterboard and okay to use drones?
I think in times of war,
it's okay to waterboard.
I think it's fine to do whatever you need to do to protect national security. And if at the time the administration thought waterboarding was what was required, that was what was required. It's rich for anyone to sit back, for Obama to, again, it's so hypocritical. And people have to be held accountable, not only for their actions, but for what they say and what they stand for when some point in the future they change for political expediency.
John Brannon.
Can I just add one other thing? I mean, one of the things, and by the way, I want the president to win in this war on terror, but one of the things that's happened is because we don't want to put anybody else in Guantanamo. We don't want to really interrogate people anymore. It's just easier to kill them instead of. There have been times when you could use troops, but this is a headache they don't want because they don't want to look like even bigger hypocrites.
What talking though about the seductive capacities of the drones to kill and possibly overusing them, I kind of wonder if the use of like Navy SEALs, you know, SEAL Team 6. Everyone just amazed at what we had happen with Osama bin Laden. Thank you. It'll be great when we can actually all really forget his name. And I think that can also lead a lot of people to thinking, well, why don't we do that more to take out these people? You know, let's send in more. As if that wasn't an incredibly complicated, dangerous project that could have had lots of casualties. I don't know that there is a you know, we're in a war, we're in a very diffuse war. Are the people who are waging the war on the other side are all over the place. They embed themselves around civilians.
Well, who are we at war with right now? Or who, better question, who are we not at war with right now? 53 France.
Canada.
53 civilians in Libya died before state-authorized U.S. force to be used in Libya. 53. No more. Last count in Syria is 65,000, I think. And I don't ever hear, aside from a little bit of, not even saber rattling, kind of like, oh, that administration's not, don't be mean to your people anymore. I don't understand who decides who are the bad guys, that there should be a drone attack, or who should get waterboarded. I don't know who the bad guys are anymore.
Okay.
It's really bad out there.
Okay. Well, let's get to some of these questions here. Let's see. And we have more coming up. I mentioned on the gun control aspect, we had some suggestions from people. So just let me know if you think these might work. Someone asks, what about having to have insurance if one owns a gun? I don't own a gun, so I don't know. Do you not need insurance now, or...
I believe that's one of the proposals in play.
Was that one that Obama suggested, or that just kind of is out
there? Isn't that a state, one of the state?
It's in the state proposal. You know, I haven't written on this, and so I haven't done homework on it. But I just look at that and think, oh, great. Because I'm sure that there are a lot of people who hold people up, and I'm sure a lot of criminals are going to run out and buy liability insurance.
I was going to say,
you're not going to get hit by a car with insurance in this state.
Yeah.
So
I buy insurance in case I get mad and go and shoot somebody, and then
or in case someone steals your gun and does something. I don't know.
Okay. Let's see. Let me ask this question first. What is it going to take to really do something about background checks, assault weapons, and mega clips? How many more children have to die? I mean, there's going to be that the Newtown pressure of, like you said, I think Todd, you said, you know. Is this really where we should be making the law from?
I don't know.
Wayne LaPierre said that, and he's the head of the NRA, that one of his criticisms has been is that it's true. There are a number of people. I mean, the background checks do work. I'm for them, and there are a number of people who go to buy guns and they find out they can't. And obviously, we want to make sure that. That they're up to date and everything else. The funny part is, though, and this is his complaint, is that people go in and they try to buy guns when they can't because they're felons, for example, and they never prosecute them. they should background checks. They're the law. We want to enforce them better. And if we can't enforce the background checks well enough, then why do we want to pass more laws that make it harder to enforce the ones that we've got?
And if you don't pass your background check and get your FOID card, you go to the Cal Palace 3 weeks ago on a Sunday and you buy a gun at a gun show that you don't need a background check or a FOID card and take your gun home. Or you go to Las Vegas any day of the week, 52 weeks a year, and you can buy a gun, drive back to San Francisco or anywhere with your new gun without a background check.
Well, this is where the federal government could play a role. You know, if background checks are required in all 50 states... at gun shows in Canada, you know, we don't have to worry about Canada, then we really only have to worry about Mexico. So that would be a place where the federal government could weigh in.
One of the audience members has a question that kind of takes us in a little bit different direction, but the coming fight on gun control is bound to worsen the national polarity, the divide here. What do you think the short and long term consequences will be of this?
I feel the questioner makes a good point. I feel that everything's polarized right now, and this is just another reason to be polarized. So certainly this debate will be come at from two different directions.
I don't want to sound alarmist but I fear that this gun debate could create like an American fall for us. I really believe that, not open violence or rebellion, but I think if the NRA and gun advocates, they're such a powerful and zealot group, I really believe we could see open... Jane, I don't want to...
Rebellion?
That's a scary word, but I believe that this could be a flashpoint issue in this country.
Two things on that. One, I think a lot of people think that gun control is a Democrat... issue and Republicans are against and Democrats are for. You'd be surprised how many Democrats are gun owners and really don't. So I don't see it as being part of the traditional divide that we look at. And of course, the more people talk about doing the heavy-handed stuff, the more people will go out and buy guns.
Yeah, so, the sales always.
So I mean, the truth is, if Washington, there are three or four things that include in background checks and where you could obviously make those more robust that could be done tomorrow, and they won't do them because people want to make this a more partisan issue and use it for their political gain, and that's a sad thing.
Someone asks, why not outlaw gun shows and make people buy guns in stores? Travel to Walmart.
Well,
I mean, think about it. There are some states where you cannot buy alcohol except in actual state-owned stores.
Right. I think, you know, getting away from the deadly potential of a gun, I mean, people use guns for target practice. People use guns for hunting, which I'm a vegetarian, but I don't do that. But and guns are also can be a form, you know, it's interesting to see. It can be a form of art or, you know, a form of, you know, this new gun can do this and has this sort of aesthetic. And I think there are people who, you know, are collectors. And so I understand why there are gun shows. It would just be nice to see some background checks, et cetera, at gun shows.
It's my understanding, and if someone that already, if you are a gun dealer at a gun show, you have to do the background checks. I'm all for saying that all gun dealers, I mean, I think that's a fine thing. Now, one of the proposals in Washington is actually requiring that if most of the guns that get passed around outside of going through a store, it's actually done within the family. Dad gives something to his kid or a cousin or whatever. And there are people who are actually trying to make that go through a background check. That's, you know, so make it for the gun shows and not for within the family. Right? Or do you want to have?
I could see someone arguing that talking about a number of these being these shootings being matters of mental illness. Father might be fine, daughter or son might not be, and we're there relying upon the parent to know, and it could be a good parent, could be a bad parent, or just an irresponsible parent.
Or someone who doesn't know she's going to get shot by her son one morning.
On that pleasant note, let us let's just tackle one more thing before we do our news quiz, and that is to head back to our first question, our first topic of the GOP Civil War. Someone asks or says, I think Republican policies of obstructionism defeated Romney. Please comment. Meaning, did the party itself help defeat him and not just... you know, his weaknesses as a candidate.
Yes.
I think Deborah hit it right on the head. It was who you hated more. And Obama and the Democrats didn't win the election. The Republicans definitely this time, I think, more so than in probably the last four or five presidential elections. The Republicans lost the election. The Democrats really didn't win the election this last time.
And there were some questions early in the campaign season about whether the Republicans were even going to step up to give full support to Romney, or were they just going to look to 2016? So those questions were bubbling from the start.
Okay. And there are a number of questions that we're asking about issues of race and gender, and basically, I would just put them all in the issues of what, like in the UK with the Tory party, where they've been talking about modernization, coming to realize they had to broaden their base. Are they going to? Can they? Will they? I'll throw that to our resident 13th Democrat that Todd, or Republican that Todd knows in the city?
If you have nothing better to do one day, go to the Harvard Kennedy School of Government website, and they have, they actually, after the election, they get the campaign consultants together to discuss what happened. And you can listen to it. I think you can watch. I think I listened to it, but you can watch it online now. It's really fascinating. I have to say, I give Barack Obama's people so much credit. They never left Ohio. They stayed there. They registered. They turned out the vote. People like me, and I was wrong, thought that young people aren't going to turn out so much for Barack Obama. Well, they did. And if it took somebody calling them every day for 2 months, they did. And if Democrats can do it, Republicans can do it. The thing is, we know that Mitt Romney just relied too much on everybody's going to agree with me. Everybody I know agrees with me, right? And he didn't. So they didn't really have the kind of GOTV, the get out the vote effort that they needed, and it can be replicated.
Okay. Well, let me just remind folks you're listening to, who are listening to us on the audio, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. Our guests on today's week-to-week program are Todd Vogt, Gina Bellaria, and Deborah J. Saunders. Let's do our news quiz. And what I need are two contestants who will come up here and compete. Can I see anyone raise their hands? Oh, come on. You've got to be more adventurous than that.
This is a brutal quiz.
You, sir.
You are brave.
Contestant number one, please stand there.
I wouldn't dare do this.
All right, who's next?
I wouldn't dare.
One other person.
I wouldn't.
No one?
We need one
right
more.
Right over there. You're laughing.
Really? Well, you're going to win by default then. You, sir, come on up.
Do you want to come to it?
Or come on down, as they say. Okay.
I can draft my husband.
Your first name is David? Okay. Why don't you come on over and stand here. And what's your first name, sir?
Kelly.
Kelly? Okay. I'm going to ask David five questions, then I'll ask you five questions. If you don't know the answer, you're welcome to ask the audience for help. If they don't know, you're welcome to ask our expert panel. And if nobody knows, should there be a tie, we'll have a tiebreaker. But are you ready? Let me give you this microphone to speak your answers into. Okay, the first question. What country tried to prove, what country tried to prove this week that it had indeed shot a monkey into space?
Iran.
Iran. Let him answer. You'll get five questions afterward.
Iran.
Is that your answer? That's right. Okay. One right.
Oh, come on. Not give
the answers. There's no way I would know if somebody didn't help me.
If they don't know the answers, then they're welcome to ask the audience for the...
So you can jump in.
Yes.
I probably don't know the answers to any of these questions.
You probably don't want to help him out, though, because that defeats the purpose. Okay, question number two. Vice President Joe Biden said this week that the United States was open to direct talks with whom?
Iraq.
Iran.
Again, don't. You'll get your five questions after he's.
So Iran's your... If you want to help me,
Yes, Iran. So that's two, right? Question number three. What U.S. senator is embroiled in a scandal amidst claims that he flew to the Dominican Republic to cavort with prostitutes?
Martinez.
Is that your answer?
Melendez. I give up.
Judges, is that close enough? I'm going to have to say no, because it's actually Robert Menendez, and he's a Democrat from New Jersey. But you've got 2-1 right now. So the fourth question, what national news channel just recorded its, according to one survey, its lowest level of public trust ever in its existence?
Oh, you know this one.
That's correct. And your final question, we all know that John Kerry replaced Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Who replaced John Kerry as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee? And I'll just say foreign relations kind of has a sad...
Can I give him the answer?
If no one here knows, you're welcome to...
Menendez.
That's right. The return of Menendez. Okay, so four right, one wrong. Please stand up, Kelly. Give a hand for David. Stay up here. We'll see who wins. We're going to ask you five questions. First one. Fox News recently cut loose two of its high-profile conservative contributors. Can you name one of them, either one?
Sarah Palin.
That's right. Sarah Palin and Dick Morris. Question number two. Is that on?
I don't know.
Maybe we'll just switch books. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Question two. What organization just delayed its decision over whether to accept gay members?
Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouts.
Well, he helped you, so you can help him. Okay, so
two
right. Okay, so this is for a question about a person. What conservative super PAC leader is trying to ensure that Republicans don't nominate any more Ted Adkins? Do you want to ask the...
Karl Rove.
That's correct. Question number four. There's a move afoot to rename SFO Airport after whom?
Harvey Milk.
Our audience is, you follow the news too well. This is, okay, question number five. So far it's four correct. If you get this one, the game is over. If not, we go to the bonus. Question number five. Yesterday, an International Space Station astronaut received a phone call, well, a satellite call probably, from a fictional predecessor who called the space station. This is a real phone call placed to the astronaut.
Oh, I heard about this.
By a fictional person?
By a real person who, I'll give you a hint, played a fictional person.
From Star Wars?
No. Do you want to, anyone, give them a hint? Help? Anyone on the panel?
I forget. I read the story in Trump.
Probably Shatner or Nimoy, but I'm not sure which one.
Shatner?
Is that your answer?
Sure.
You won, sir. Congratulations. Stand for Kelly. Second place. Congratulations. It's a close second. Well fought.
No problem.
Okay. Sorry. Oh, the bonus question for anyone. Name the governor who ate donuts during an appearance with David Letterman. Chris Christie. Okay. That's our program for this week. Don't forget to join us on our big evening program on Monday, March 4th here. And check out our weekly news quiz on Huffington Post San Francisco every Friday. Thank you to our panel, Gina Bellaria, Deborah J. Saunders, and Todd Vogt.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you. Let's go out and enjoy some refreshments. Have a great weekend.